virtually every place we've sent a spacecraft on a first reconnaissance mission like this, that we find out that our Earth-based notions were flat wrong.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer. And Bob, I'm very much looking forward to this show. I know it's going to be one of my favorites because we're going to do another one of our signature list shows.
Yes, Real Science Radio's list of problems with the solar system formation.
And what impeccable timing. I mean, for the first time in history this week, we flew a spacecraft past Pluto. And all of this evidence is pouring in, and thanks to, now get this, operation science employed by NASA, we're learning lots of good stuff.
And Fred, I thank God, literally, Lord, thank you, that NASA didn't use their origin science to get to Pluto, because their theory on the origin of the solar system is in tatters. That's the topic of today's program. Just like their theory on the origin of the universe, their Big Bang theory. You know, people Google evidence against the Big Bang, or they Google Big Bang predictions, and you'll find near the top, or usually at the top, our shows on those topics. Evidence against the Big Bang, and another favorite show, Big Bang Predictions.
Yeah, but tonight it's our list of solar system formation problems in honor of this spacecraft called New Horizons that's doing this flyby by Pluto. And already, you know, NASA, of course, they claim that Pluto is, what, billions of years old.
Yeah, what isn't?
Yeah. So they've already found evidence of youth in the mountains of Pluto's surface. So this is going to be really cool to look at that.
Fred, what about predictions regarding Pluto that are made by the young Earth creation model? Well, you just touched on one there in reverse. Pluto will appear young, according to young Earth creationists.
Exactly.
Right? It'll appear young. Less than 10,000 years old, and so will its moons, like everything else, in fact. So what do we find? Let's look at the evidence, and this is out this week, July 15th, 2015, from NASA's own website.
From their own website, and we already heard an audio clip at the very beginning of the show on, you know, how every time they send one of these spacecraft up, their predictions are just blown out of the water. And ours oftentimes are confirmed. I mean, we could go on and on about, but now we've got some more, and it's great.
So they're saying, you know, we always point out when they're surprised, they're shocked, they're amazed, and not just at a discovery, but usually they say that when the discovery contradicts their theory, the fundamental expectations of the theory. So here's from nasa.gov/mission/New Horizons/Maine, right? Here it is, new close-up images of Pluto reveals a giant surprise, not a little surprise, a giant surprise, a range of youthful mountains. So this is fun because they believe that Pluto, you know, it formed in the early stages of the solar system, which formed 4.5 billion years ago. That's what they think. Well, it turns out that Pluto has mountain ranges that seem to have virtually no craters. And if they have no craters, that means they haven't been there for billions of years. And so to them, it's not just a surprise. It's a giant surprise, but it fits perfectly in a young Earth worldview.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, they say that Pluto may still be geologically active. And there's a reason they say that. It's a double-edged sword, really.
Yeah.
Because if it's geologically active, that's a problem in itself, right?
Because
you wouldn't expect
tiny.
That. You'd expect it to be a dead planet after all these billions of years.
A dead ice ball.
It's interesting why they say that, because, you know, they say because of these few craters, they say, however, relatively few craters are visible, indicating a relatively young surface. And here's the catch. Here's their rescue device that has been reshaped by geologic activity. So that rescues them.
So huge. Right. It rescues them from one problem.
They use an enemy to rescue them because that's not really a friend of them to claim there's geologic activity going on.
It's an enormous problem. Pluto is tiny. It's like The diameter of Pluto is like twice the width of Texas. It's tiny, relatively speaking. It should be a dead, cold chunk of rock and ice. They think mostly ice, you know, but rock and ice. And so it turns out that we already know there are small bodies, moons, like Jupiter's moon Io, that have geysers on them. They should be dead after billions of years. So what do the secular scientists say? They say, well, they got to find a solution. So in that case, they say tidal pumping, the gravity from Jupiter is heating up the planet enough to make it geologically active.
Are they able to do that with Pluto? Is there anything nearby enough to do that?
They have admitted. Now, I don't think with Jupiter or other planets, I don't think the math works.
Yeah.
They just need a solution. But with Pluto, they've already admitted that gravitational interaction, tidal pumping, is not going to do it. So why is Pluto geologically active? Right off the bat, it's as fun as could be. The photos are still coming in. The New Horizons spacecraft came within 6,200 miles of the surface of Pluto. That's really exciting. So they're saying, based on these mountain ranges and other areas too, Fred, they're saying this part of Pluto, the surface part, it has to be not half as old as Pluto, not a quarter, not a tenth, not a 20th, but maybe 2% of Pluto's age. That's about it. So to them, they're super young.
So it's amazing. Another prediction, you know, for our predictions come true, theirs don't.
Yeah, really, really fun. Then we have the largest moon. Pluto has 5 known moons. It would fit our model that it may have more than 5. Just like we've said, comets and asteroids will have more complex debris fields than is generally expected. But how about Charon, Pluto's largest moon? Any surprises there?
So on NASA.gov's website, they claim that Charon, this moon of Pluto, has a surprising youthful terrain. Guess why? Because they don't find the pockmarks again. They don't find the craters.
Right.
It's a young surface.
So it's the same problem. It has a chasm larger than the Grand Canyon, which is cool.
Yeah.
And they're pointing out that when they look south of the moon's equator, the angle of the sunlight makes shadows that are so long, so the topography is easy to distinguish. And they said even there are relatively few craters, indicating a relatively young surface. Now, we hear that everywhere. Spike Passaris made a whole video about that, what they aren't telling you about astronomy, volume 1 and 2. In fact, Fred, we sell Spike's videos. They're the best astronomy videos ever made. And they're at our store, realscienceradio.com. Just click on the store and browse the science department. I think folks would love Spike's videos. They're just so wonderful.
Oh, they're great. And by the way, it's the telethon. I mean, you know, we have to raise money to stay on the air, right? Got to pay for radio time.
Our goal is $30,000 for the month of July. We're well into the month, and we're at about $10,000. So thank you so much, everyone who's donated. But we really need the funds. We don't have a big foundation behind us. We don't have any foundation.
Yeah.
We don't have a large mega church. We have the Lord, Fred, you, me, Jamie, and our listeners.
And some great materials in the store. I mean, you can get the Hydroplate video, Walt Brown's great
Global
book.
Global Flood, and Walt Brown's book in the beginning. And people could make a one-time donation or a monthly donation, or subscribe to our Bible studies or our topical videos.
And the very popular The Plot. What a great book.
Oh, My Life's Work, an overview of the Bible.
Highly recommend it.
Really fun. An overview of the Bible is the key to its details.
Yes.
And the details are the doctrines. It's just so fun. So, Fred, I guess that's it for Charon, the largest moon of Pluto for now, right? Charon also has given them the huge surprise, giant surprise with
Pluto. Yeah, I mean, if it's billions of years old, it should have lots of space debris on it, right? We had that great guest, a couple weeks ago, Dr. Henry Richter, who was a scientist for JPL, which eventually became NASA.
Dr. Henry Richter.
And he was team lead for the first satellite that we put into space.
Yes, yes.
And he confirmed on air that they had expected a huge amount of dust on the moon.
Because they thought it was billions of years old.
Yeah, that a lot of time for dust to accumulate. So they really did expect it, and they didn't.
Back then, and the moon dust problem for NASA has just reared its ugly head again.
Yeah.
Only now, way out, 3 billion miles further.
The Pluto and Charon dust problem.
Yes, right. Because if they're billions of years old, whatever rock and ice formed them and is on the surface, it should be covered with a lot of dust, right? It should be like a dirty snowball, sort of like a comet in a way.
Yeah.
Well, we have an audio clip from a documentary on the Science Channel, Passport to Pluto, NASA New Horizons Update, and NASA scientists are throughout this one-hour documentary. But let's hear this short audio clip about their fresh snow on Pluto problem. Let's hear this.
Strangely enough, Pluto's surface seems to have about the same brightness as freshly fallen snow on Earth. It appears so dim only because it's so small and very far away. Equally bizarre, Pluto sometimes behaves more like a comet than a planet. When its eccentric orbit brings it closer to the sun, the surface heats up and produces a denser atmosphere.
So Fred, like the albedo on the Earth, where the Earth reflects so much of the sun's energy light back into space, over the North Pole, there's a lot of ice. The global warming folks don't like that, but there's a lot of ice. And so the light reflects really well. So in this Science Channel documentary, the scientists are pointing out that this is a problem. Even snow is a problem for atheist and secular origins folks.
Well, another thing, Bob, why are they so close together? Why is Pluto and Charon so close together? I know that, you know, they have a collision hypothesis, right?
Oh, everything, right?
Planet catastrophists.
Yeah, they are. They believe in catastrophes. They're addicted to catastrophes and the most unlikely catastrophes.
Except for on Earth.
On Earth, they have made fun for 150 years. The naturalist, secularist, atheist have made fun of Christians, creationists, because we look at the surface of the Earth and we see a catastrophe in the geologic record and billions of dead things laid down by water all over the Earth. So when you come to planetary origins, it turns out that the planets, they just don't work. They can't figure out how a naturalistic origin, the nebular hypothesis, would create the planets as they are. Like Mercury doesn't fit. So they say, well, Mercury formed, and then there was a planetary collision.
Yeah.
And Mars formed, Venus formed, the planets, the moons, you get all the way out to Pluto, and sure enough, Pluto had a cosmic collision billions of years ago with Charon. And so now here they are.
Yeah.
Well, what's the chances of planetary collisions even with the force of gravity? Planets, we got a big solar system, and these things are millions of miles apart, and out past Neptune and the trans-Neptunian objects, the TNOs, the space between the average TNO, it's a lot. It's 3 AUs.
3 AUs.
What's an AU?
Almost uncirculated?
No. An AU is an astronomical unit, which is the distance from the sun to the Earth. So you've got 3 AUs distance between each of the TNOs. They think there's maybe 70,000 of them.
And then they need them to collide at some point, right?
They need them to collide.
What happens in a collision, Bob?
They need them to form moons like crazy.
Collisions usually aren't good, are they? I mean, it's a collision.
Yeah, you know? In space, when two, say, meteoroids collide, they don't join together to
they start
forming. They
don't coalesce into a ball.
No, they don't start forming a planetesimal. They typically bounce off each. Well, for one, they don't even hit. They just pass each other.
Well, let's say
they
do hit.
Speed up and they go. If they do hit, they bust each other up. If they're any kind of size at all.
I'm pretty sure I threw a dirt clod once and I hit another dirt clod and it all formed one dirt clod.
Yeah, right.
No, wrong.
Exactly. So in space, these things are going thousands of miles an hour. And what the atheists need to happen is for these random objects to merge together, they need that to happen trillions, quadrillions, quintillions of times when it's wildly, wildly, wildly unlikely that it would happen once. It's just like with the origin of life, of proteins, enzymes, DNA molecules, everything.
They just say it happened.
It's so wildly unlikely to ever happen once in a quadrillion years, and they think it happened trillions of times.
Yeah.
it is funny. So, okay, so they're catastrophists. They're planetary catastrophists. They deny a catastrophe on Earth, one.
Yep.
They believe in countless catastrophes of the planets, which are so far apart. And they deny Earth had a global flood, yet they think Mars had a near global flood.
Yeah, that's right. Why do they base their opinion that Mars had a global flood? They look at the surface, right?
They look at the surface. They see some evidence. And so even though it's bone dry,
yeah,
they say, well, there was
no water there. And the Earth's surface is covered by what, about two thirds water,
right,
at least?
More than a mile deep. And they, oh, yeah, Earth could have never had a global flood. But desert dry Mars probably did, or almost a global flood. It is funny. Okay, so Fred, the New Horizons spacecraft, it didn't stop at Pluto. It's zipping by almost 31,000 miles per hour, and there's seven science instruments that have been gathering data. So since Pluto was discovered way back when, do you recall how long ago it was discovered?
Well, yeah, it was about, I don't know, 80 years ago, 1930.
By
some guy named Clyde Tombaugh.
And I believe it was discovered at Lowell Observatory, and we took a homeschool class trip. No. And we took a homeschool field trip to the Lowell Observatory, a science field trip. Cheryl and I, we brought our boys. And so for all this time, since 1930 till today, you know, Pluto was just barely a data point. And now we know so much, and NASA says, Pluto, the plot thickens.
Yeah.
The ice plot thickens because it's got an abundance of methane ice, a thick transparent slab of nitrogen ice. We have predictions about the objects in the solar system that were not planets. Here at Real Science Radio, we follow Walt Brown's hydroplate theory and the fountains of the great deep ejecting the comets, asteroids, meteoroids, and the trans-Neptunian objects.
And oh, by the way, the moon has pockmarks on it on the near side, right? Much more than the far side.
Yeah, the near side of the moon is really beat up as compared to the far side, which is really sprinkled with a lot of craters, but nothing like the major impacts on the near side. And all the Mara, the seas, with all the huge chunks of the moon's near side became molten. Well, Fred, the planets that God created, the planets, not these other maverick objects in the solar system that don't quite conform to the ecliptic and that behave like comets. And so God created the planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. All the TNOs and all the asteroids and all the comets and all the meteoroids and all the dust in the solar system, it was ejected by the fountains of the great deep, which is why all the matter in those things looks like terrestrial matter.
Yep.
And it would comprise less than 4% of the mass of the Earth. All that stuff.
Yep.
Including Pluto, including Charon.
And we have a show where we talk about how all these comet scientists are doing the work for Walt Brown.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because they're helping to confirm his theory. So I'd say that's the first item in our list of problems with the solar system formation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that what they've discovered.
And it's cutting edge too. Just today we're getting reports.
Yes, exactly. And so as we look at the Pluto system, Pluto and its five known moons, maybe more, it turns out that it's not what was predicted by their model. So now we go to a second problem on the list. We'll sort of read off the list in a moment, but first let's talk about the second problem, is that their theory of solar system formation, it's called the nebular hypothesis, that there's a gas cloud out in space and it's spinning, a rotating gas cloud, and it gradually condenses into what becomes a star and planets, a planetary system orbiting the star. So it turns out that that whole theory is in tatters.
Oh, it's been for a long time. I mean, even Sir Isaac Newton, this theory happened before his time, and he said it was nonsense.
Well, that's exactly right. And maybe we should quote him a little later in the program, but a scientist and astronomer more recently, an astronomer, Mike Brown, talked about the theory and the problem with the theory, and he is NASA's database manager.
At the California Institute of Technology.
Caltech. They manage NASA's planetary database. They now have, what, about 1,500 planets. So not only the eight in our solar system, but planets orbiting other stars, exoplanets. And so Mike Brown, he said something about their theory that has stunned a lot of people. Do you want to share that?
Sure. This is great. He said, before we ever discovered any planets outside the solar system, we thought we understood the formation of planetary systems pretty deeply. It was a really beautiful theory and clearly thoroughly wrong.
Thoroughly wrong. So our theory of how solar systems form, it was beautiful. And it was, wasn't it? You tell a wonderful story.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Bob, when I came in the studio today, our producer came up with this clip that he played at the start of the show.
Yeah.
Can I hear that again? I mean, this really fits right here.
Yeah, I think it does, because it turns out that the parts of the theory, the model of how solar systems should be, it's not only that it's falsified with the over 1,000 exoplanets, it's also falsified by all the planets in our own solar system.
That's right.
So, you know, so this is, again, a Science Channel documentary, Passport to Pluto, NASA New Horizons update. And this quote is from a planetary scientist in the documentary named Alan Stern, and he's with the Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins University.
Virtually every place we've sent a spacecraft on a first reconnaissance mission like this, that we find out that our Earth-based notions were flat wrong.
Okay, flat wrong.
Flat wrong.
So it's not just creationists who are reminding the public, and predictions are the stock and trade of science.
It's the way science is supposed to work, right?
Right. You have a model. You make predictions about what you're going to find when you get to Pluto or when you get to Saturn. When you orbit Mercury and Mars and all, you make predictions, and the predictions are always flat wrong. Whereas the creationist predictions are usually spot on.
Yeah. Go to our store and get Walt Brown's book and you'll see what we mean.
Yeah. Walt Brown's book In the Beginning and Spike Pisaris's DVDs on What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. Really fun. So we're going to list problems with our own solar system, but regarding the topic Mike Brown, astronomer Mike Brown, was talking about, where their beautiful theory was thoroughly wrong. It is thoroughly wrong. He was talking about the exoplanets mostly. Mm-hmm. Everything about them contradicts the theory of how a solar system would form. Their sizes, their mass, their composition, their orbital characteristics. Fred, they have planets that orbit retrograde to the star's rotation.
And that goes against the laws of physics.
Yeah, the conservation of angular momentum. It's just a shock to them. Not because they discovered something new. That's not shocking. That's just fun. It's a shock when it contradicts their model. Highly inclined orbits, hot Jupiters. By the model, the rocky planets, smaller rocky planets, are supposed to form close to the star.
Mm-hmm.
And the gas giants form further away. Well, they have discovered what they call hot Jupiters because they're these massive gas giants that are real close to their stars. So effectively, they falsified their model. So there's another quote from this documentary. And I find this interesting because it gives us a little glimpse into the way that the solar system formation theory was ad hoc. An ad hoc applies to this instance.
Yeah.
So they knew we had planets orbiting a star. So going way back to, like you said, the time of Isaac Newton, it was proposed that gravity, his gravity, could take gas and coalesce it into a sun and planets. And Isaac Newton very clearly, with the most brilliant insight of the world's most effective scientist, and he said, no, my system of gravity would not permit that. It would require the hand of the creator to get the planets moving in their proper orbits around the sun. Nice of him to say that so bluntly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isaac Newton.
Top scientist of his day, really.
Yeah. Well, atheists and secular scientists, they need an explanation. They want one of how our solar system come to exist. So they say, well, you get this gas cloud, it's spinning, and it would cause the star to form with rocky planets nearby and gas giants out further and so on. Well, the only reason they said that is because that's what they saw.
Yeah.
It's ad hoc.
Like you said, ad hoc.
Right. Yeah. If our solar system, if God had made it totally differently, they would have said, oh, of course, when gas molecules come together, they'd form whatever we happen to see.
Kind of like cosmic background radiation, right?
Exactly.
Discovered it. Oh, the Big Bang predicted that. No, it didn't.
Exactly. So go to the Big Bang predictions, Google Big Bang predictions, and get the real story of the Big Bang predictions. So let's hear this clip again from the Science Channel program Passport to Pluto, this NASA New Horizons update. And this will have three scientists speaking, actually. One is Dr. Hal Weaver from Johns Hopkins University, then Alan Stern, like previously, planetary scientist, and then Mark Bowie, who's an astronomer at the Lowell Observatory. And so listen carefully. Maybe we need to play it twice so the audience could pick up what's really being said.
Outer edge of the solar system, poor little Pluto, all on its own.
Then in the 1990s came a series of discoveries that changed everything. Researchers found more and more icy objects in a massive region of the outer solar system known as the Kuiper Belt.
And once we discovered the Kuiper Belt, everything sort of fell into place. The understanding that, in fact, Pluto and Charon are members of this other class of objects called the ice dwarfs.
And in fact, we think that these ice dwarfs are the most populous class of planetary body in our entire solar system.
That tells us, from that respect, Pluto's not special. It's got lots of company out there.
Okay. So they took a mystery and they multiplied it. Now they have thousands of mysteries.
A whole bunch more mysteries.
How did they all get out there? Why are they there? And so it's sort of like a sleight of hand. It's like, well, we really couldn't understand Pluto. And then there were thousands of Plutos. So now it all fit together. There's no, all they're doing is accommodating what
they
they've
act
discovered.
Like they discovered something, or that they're proving a point. You know, it's kind of like when they say now that in the fossil record, if something doesn't change over millions of years, it's the same thing as it was then. Right. That's proof of evolution, because evolution would allow things not to change.
Right.
That's
right.
Dumb.
Right. Everything you find,
they're
is
getting
proof.
Really desperate.
Everything you find is proof of their theory.
That's right.
No matter what you find.
When you find evidence against the theory, it's proof for their theory.
So now let's listen to that one last time, and then we'll do the conclusion of today's program next week on Real Science Radio, where we'll go through the list. But let's hear that one more time and try to pick out the ad hoc nature of the claim that we're now able to understand why Pluto is there, because there are thousands of Plutos. That doesn't explain why. That just multiplied your problem by thousands. Let's hear it.
Then in the 1990s came a series of discoveries that changed everything. Researchers found more and more icy objects in a massive region of the outer solar system known as the Kuiper Belt.
And once we discovered the Kuiper Belt, everything sort of fell into place. The understanding that, in fact, Pluto and Charon are members of this other class of objects called the ice dwarfs.
And in fact, we think that these ice dwarfs are the most populous class of planetary body in our entire solar system.
That tells us, from that respect, Pluto's not special. It's got lots of company out there.
And it's got lots of company, and it's a bigger mystery. So, Fred, we're out of time, but I'd love to give a preview of part two. So here's what we're going to cover. Problems with the formation of the solar system. Our sun is missing nearly 100% of its spin that was predicted by their theory. Almost 100%. It's not
almost
spinning
all of it
like it's supposed to. The sun's rotation is 7 degrees off of the ecliptic of the planets. The planets should be orbiting around the sun's equator. They're 7 degrees off. How did that happen? That's a strong argument against the theory. The theory predicts uniform distribution of elements in the solar system, of isotopes of different elements. That's like flavors, like nitrogen comes in different flavors, different isotopes, oxygen, carbon, and so
we've
on.
We've got quotes of them mentioning this prediction and they admitting that this prediction failed.
So when you look at the moon, the isotopes of the same elements on the moon versus the Earth versus the sun, it doesn't look like they all came from a swarm of homogeneous elements. It looks like each one was specially created.
And Lawrence Krauss, I think, agrees with you kind of on this next one.
Oh, yeah, that the Earth does not have a uniform distribution of radioactivity. In fact, 90% of it is in the continental crust, and even that preferentially near granite. Then there's the fine-tuning of the solar system that is not expected by the nebular hypothesis. And then, this is such a fun one, the transient events in the solar system.
Yeah, short-term comets, all kinds of these transient things going on.
There are dozens of events in the solar system that we shouldn't be able to see if the solar system is billions of years old, like things that are just happening. And they say every time, wow, isn't it amazing that we're here to see that? The rings of Saturn have been there for billions of years, and we're watching them change so dramatically. So that's fun. Then there is the planetary formation problem and the star formation problem, which really was highlighted by how difficult it is to land a spacecraft on a comet, 67 Philae landing. And then, Fred, there's the rounded boulders on comets.
Yeah, that'll be a good one to talk about. Oh, Why are they rounded?
Because if comets formed in the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt, then how do they have rounded boulders?
Nice, smoothly rounded.
It's so fun. And you have Mercury having greater density than could be accounted for by just evolutionary accretion, these meteors coming together. And the rapid decaying magnetic field strength of Mercury and the Earth. And then you've got planets that are not quite rotating the way they're supposed to.
And Uranus rotates perpendicularly, and Venus rotates backwards.
Backwards. So that's quite a list of problems with solar system formation, just like the size of the sun, the size of the planet.
Yeah, so stay tuned for why the boulders shouldn't be round, why they are round. That's kind of an interesting story.
That is.
Hey, a teaser, Bob, for next week.
I can't wait. So thank you, Fred Williams, and this is Bob Enyart for Real Science Radio. And remember, our telethon, the goal is $30,000. Please help us to stay on the air. And you could go to our store, kgov.com, click on the store, browse the science department, or you can make a donation or sign up for a subscription. I think you'll love it, and you'll encourage us so much. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
Virtually every place we've sent a spacecraft on a first reconnaissance mission like this, that we find out that our Earth-based notions were flat wrong.